Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to EAN Cast. And today our topic will be on the part of the series called RZK. Kids, Small Adults, organized by the Scientific Panel of Child Neurology of the European Academy of Neurology subtopic. The main item we will discuss today will be on autism spectrum disorder, the patients having ASD, and the transition from their early childhood into adolescence and afterwards into an adulthood. My name is Taras Voloshin. I'm a Ukrainian doctor specialized in autistic disorders. I have my PhD thesis done on ASD patients. We have two guests along with me. That is Dr. Lavanya Damodaran. She's a consultant pediatric liaison neuropsychiatrist at the Birmingham Children's Hospital from Birmingham, UK, and Dr. Osman Malik, he's a consultant, child and adolescent neuropsychiatrist from Evelina London Children's Hospital, also from UK. So we are glad to congratulate you here, and we hope we'll have a fruitful discussion. Welcome to both of you. Thank you for joining us today and for making such a great company. We may start from Lavanya Damodaran, yes, and you will be the first one to introduce us the topic of ASD diagnostic criteria and let's say these core features of the disease.
Thank you very much for EAN and Taras for this invite, and I am pleased to be here along with a colleague, Dr. Malik, to talk about autism spectrum disorder. It is a neurodevelopmental condition characterized by persistent deficits in social communication and interaction in multiple contexts, as well as having restricted repetitive patterns of behavior, interests, or activities as per DSM-5. Now, symptoms must be present in the early developmental period, but there is also a caveat that I will explain in the next question. Symptoms tend to cause significant impairment in social, occupational, and important areas of functioning. These are captured with semi-structured assessments such as autism diagnostic observation schedule 2, autism diagnostic interview revised within a multidisciplinary setting in children, and there are use of questionnaires like autism spectrum quotient in adult settings.
So what's your opinion, Dr. Damodaran? Is it a fundamentally same disease in small kids and in adults? How do you think? What's your personal opinion on that?
Personally, having looked after children, as well as young adults as they transition into their adulthood, we would say that we tend to see the core features, the core diagnostic features of autism present throughout the lifespan. They might manifest slightly differently based on their skills and experiences, life experiences. However, but you know, we would still say that they are similar. Also, looking at the diagnostic features, the requirement is that they persist throughout life, regardless of when the diagnosis is made. So important features of DSM-5 definition that supports diagnosis in adulthood are that diagnostic behavior descriptions apply to all ages. Behavior contributing to a diagnosis can be current or historical. And the criterion of a specific early age of onset is no longer required. And it's been replaced by symptoms must be present in early developmental period, but may not fully manifest until social demands exceed limited capacities that individuals might have, or may be masked by learning strategies in their later life. So based on the stressors or life experience or the social demands, academic demands, work demands, they may present a little later where the core features have been present before but might have not manifested in a way that leads to a diagnostic process.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Damodaran. Dr. Malik, could you please briefly explain to us about these early signs that we may look at and we may, let's say, take care of in the early stages that we may look at and, let's say, distinguish in between this within normal limit, within normal limits, kit and in between the pathology itself?
Sure. There are a number of features that we look for in children, and we might call them early signs or childhood features that will indicate or give us a clue that the child may be on the autism spectrum. And one of the most common ones is a speech delay. The important thing about speech delay is that it is not necessary that if a child has a speech delay, then they must have autism, because they could have a speech delay and just go on to have a speech and language disorder without autism. But it is very common. On the other hand, there are also young people with autism who've never had a speech delay. And in the past, we would make a distinction that if you had a speech delay and other features of autism, we'd call that typical autism or childhood autism. And then if you didn't, then we would have to use a different label like Asperger's or atypical autism. But now it's all merged into one. So we keep this as an important sign, speech delay, but it's not an essential sign. The other thing is that we look for in early childhood is response to name. And again, this is not an essential feature, but some children, when you call out their name, may not respond. It could be they're busy, but if there's a consistent pattern, then they sometimes don't automatically recognize that they're being addressed. Another thing is eye contact. Again, this is variable because now the autism spectrum is widened. So we do have people who do make some, but if we do notice early lack of eye contact, we also look for sensory issues. And even though, again, sensory issues, you can see sensory issues in people who don't have autism, like ADHD, or no diagnoses, but they are common and more extreme. So the child might react excessively to sounds, and parents will think that, you know, the fireworks or the hand dryers extremely triggers my child. Then there is the rigidity, that if there's a change in the pattern or they're refusing to put socks on, extreme behaviors, extreme dysregulation, if the plans are changed. And one other important thing is patterns of playing. Sometimes when children, particularly when they're in a social environment, like in a nursery or a kindergarten, and a parent observes a child or at a birthday party, and they notice that my child was playing with the truck and not necessarily part of group play, or even in group play, they were on the sidelines. So these are important features, how they are playing, how they manage little changes, sensory issues, eye contact, the speech and language delay. But even if they don't have delay, we look at patterns like some children with autism will have echolalia, where they will repeat a lot, copy somebody, and they might go through a phase where they are not referring to themselves as I in the first person. They might say, if there's a boy, he might say, he wants to go out, he wants a sandwich, instead of saying their name. We also look for other signs like stimming, so the hand movements and flapping. And we look for tiptoe walking. So those are the sort of early signs. But one important thing just to add here, as Lavanya said, that within the autism spectrum, now we're recognizing that it is not essential that we should pick up all the signs before a certain age, like age 2 or age 3. Because there are children who may have some subtle features and they only become really prominent a little bit later on when the demands increase at school, social demands and expectations. So I think that's been a slow evolution of those symptoms. Whilst in the past, it was always language delay, always pick up before age 3. Now, whilst early signs are there and they're important because the earlier you identify you can offer interventions. The interventions are not to change autism, but to improve quality of life, yes? So those, I would say, are important signs to look out for. And I think even in clinics, if you're a clinician who is not necessarily running an autism clinic, a pediatrician, cardiac or neurologist, and you see a child who's tiptoe walking, who's stimming, who's got sensory issues, eye contact and all those things, it may give you a clue as a clinician. Then you may not diagnose a child because you feel like, I'm not an expert, but you feel like, okay, tick the language you ask, and then you may make a referral or signpost parents.
Dr. Malik, may I ask you about your personal experience? What do you think about the early recognition of the disease? Are that the parents or medical staff workers, consultant pediatrician, child neurologist, psychiatrist that usually sees these early signs and puts out the diagnosis? That is the first one to state that this is autistic case.
Yes. I think that it varies quite a lot depending on people's experiencing of seeing neurodiverse young children. The more experienced they are more likely to detect and refer them for an assessment. And sometimes these children don't get identified till much later on when they have problems in the school environment. So that's a common reason for referral, even though these signs were there, but the child had a lot of problems, school refusal or problems when they started secondary school. And it's only then that they become prominent. So often they're missed, particularly in females. I won't go into detail because I know that Lavanya is going to talk a little bit about females and that presentation, but that is one example of where often these early features are missed or they're subtle, and so the diagnosis is a bit later on. Now, is there an advantage of picking up early? There are some studies, more from the speech and language side, about early interventions. Again, not necessarily to change autism, but to improve communication and language.
Yeah. Thank you. And maybe Dr. Lavanya will tell us more about this adulthood stage. Yeah, so about the presentation of ASD and clinical signs in adulthood, that so-called camouflaging, the problems with relations, with the social behavior, the problems of higher rates of comorbidities, and underdiagnosing of the disease as it is. Yeah. So may you tell us more about how does autism and ASD cases reveal themselves, manifest themselves clinically throughout adulthood, and why do these adult patients still need care? They need psychiatric care, they need care from their families, they need social interaction. Yeah, so can you just briefly explain us about this adulthood stage and why do we speak overall, not just about the kids having ASD, but about adults having ASD as well?
Thank you very much. As Osman pointed out, some of the really unique features that we pick up in children, such as, you know, they don't respond to their name being called, or they might not smile back in a social setting, and they might actually exhibit in the form of a meltdown because of sensory overload. These things might be very different in adulthood. So the presentation could be that the adults are trying to actually intellectually, you know, manage the situation in a different way. So there may be a level of awareness. Not that some of the children don't have the awareness, but adults probably over the years with experience, they become more aware of their, you know, struggles. And then they try and adapt themselves in settings, which includes a group of people or social setting or work setting. They try and, you know, may intellectualize it, but then they might try to struggle. They might struggle to apply the coping strategies sometimes, and it could result in, you know, social anxiety. They might actually be intensely fatigued after a social setting or a meeting. They might actually struggle really significantly with, you know, when the relationship becomes a bit more complex as they are young adults or through their adulthood, the friendship might not be just around play. It might be complex interactions about situations within the world that we live in. And those kind of situations might be real big struggle. And, you know, lasting friendships might be tricky because they might prefer to talk about their own special interest sometimes. And that might not be the other, you know, colleagues or friends' interest. So these kind of situations might become quite tricky. And some of the research also would suggest that, you know, adults with autism might have, you know, some level of adapted social skills, but then the core need for routine and sensory sensitivities might just remain for longer period of time that becomes tricky for them to manage. I suppose it's very important for, whether it's family, whether it's close friendship, when they're building relationships, for them to be aware of, employers to be aware of, and even sometimes that it could be that up until that point they haven't been diagnosed, and that recognizing those struggles at that stage, and then trying to help make those referrals for diagnostic confirmation would be important. And so education is necessary for employers, for example, or even family members that might be closely involved with the adults. So, you know, we were talking about underdiagnosis, weren't we? So you did suggest about underdiagnosis. So there is experience clinically as well as data to research-wise to suggest that underdiagnosis is present and it's more common in women or girls. Now, why might that be the case? So, you know, sometimes it could be that we've had really superficial understanding of what autism spectrum conditions are, and over a period of time, we've developed our understanding about autism, especially if you think about some of the myths that we might hold, that when a woman is actually making the eye contact, making a conversation, is married, is a mother, playing those roles, that means, maybe, you know, she's not autistic. But so those, generalization might not apply. So there may be a level of coping strategies that they might have developed. There may be a level of masking, camouflaging that they might have developed over a period of time. And also, what is the female phenotype? You know, what are the strengths being a female genetically? Is that sometimes then comes in the way of recognizing and diagnosing, for example, you know, being able to socially adapt a bit better as a woman. Now, we may need to actually think about some of the nuances that a young person or an adult who, you know, from gender point of view or sex point of view, that, they might, girls might show, women might show certain interest, restricted interest that might involve people, that might mean that they are interested in a pop group or certain literature or certain authors, and they might be interested in certain animals, as compared to boys or men that might be interested in objects or things like planes or cars. So those are the things that we might need to keep in mind. And also, imaginative play might be present in some of the girls, but they might be very much non-reciprocal play, or they might be very scripted. So things that some of the women, girls might pick up, and then it might then be masked in terms of how they present. So we, I think, need to be more mindful of how it might present differently. And in that, you know, that way we might be able to improve the diagnostic process for women. And that way we might be able to prevent some of the underdiagnosis overall in adults. Also, when intellectually people are very capable, individuals are very capable, we do see sometimes even in our professional lives that some of the colleagues might have a lot of insight about their struggles and reflect about it, but that may not have been picked up because they are really high functioning, you know, holding big jobs, big positions. And these are things that we might need to be mindful of, I suppose. I know that we also wanted to touch upon some of the struggles that adults might have. And these struggles might be presented in the way of, you know, when they are trying to start to live independently, for example, and they are trying to take more responsibility, take on full-time jobs, and then it might then present in terms of, you know, difficulties and that might, you know, be present alongside the core features of autism. Say, for example, if they are struggling with executive functioning, then they might struggle with planning, organizing, initiating tasks or managing time. So, and being able to identify what individual strengths might be and what kind of jobs might better suit them, for example, it would be important. Vocational training might be indicated to help this kind of transition. And as I mentioned before, again, education and training for employers create a supportive and nurturing environment. So building new relationships with colleagues and friends might not be easy. They might burn out trying to camouflage and fit in within their newfound relationships. And hence then friendships and relationships become unsustainable for them. So individuals being able to leverage some of the special interests, participate in structured kind of social settings with a level of predictable environment might be helpful in building confidence. And I know you did say how else it might be presenting in a kind of even a clinical setting, for example. So there can be high levels of coexisting conditions. We know this from when we look after children with autism, that we do tend to find that children do have other coexisting conditions like anxiety, depression. So in a similar way, adults also have higher coexisting condition when they are diagnosed with autism. So we will have to be mindful in identifying, recognizing those coexisting psychiatric comorbidities, that is. So some of them can be depressive disorder, anxiety disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and personality disorders. So reasons that, if we think about it, could be because co-occurring disorders include shared pathophysiology with autism or the cause. For example, epilepsy and autism, ADHD and autism, or anxiety and autism. So similarly, if we think about when they've lived with autism for a period of time within academic setting, within employment setting, within other social setting, you know, how might that impact on their mood? I know they might be prone for developing depression. And there are also other ways of understanding. Sometimes there could be overlapping symptom dimensions. And maybe there are possible shared underlying mechanisms, like when there is OCD. Overlapping diagnostic criteria sometimes when we think about schizoid personality disorders, schizotypal personality disorder, obsessive compulsive or anancastic personality, for example. Those are things that we need to keep in mind that may not seem quite straightforward unless we are able to, you know, professionals are able to, even from primary care point perspective, able to identify and refer on to appropriate services for that diagnosis to be made and for them to be treated in a timely manner so that they can function better in life and be able to do their best in their life. So that's something that I wanted to talk about. Yeah.
I think that's quite important here. And let's say about the overall functioning, when the transition happened itself into an adulthood, of course it's challenging, but we see a lot of famous people, including like Bill Gates, Elon Musk, etc. They were diagnosed as ASDs ages before, but currently they are functioning pretty well and earning pretty well and owning the company. So it is possible. And of course, some senses problem or some mood problems may be compensated by the hard work or the necessity of the proper skills that were required from those adults having ASDs. And Dr. Malik, it will be interesting to listen to you, to your opinion on this continuity. What are the symptoms that are transformed into an adulthood, and how are they shaped by the age, how are they shaped by the ambience, by social demands, how important is this transition from the early childhood into an adulthood for to have this lifelong support in terms of the families, in terms of medical care? Yeah, could you just briefly tell us more on the topic?
Sure, yes. So I think continuing from what Lavanya was saying about the childhood and how it autism presents in childhood and adulthood, I would say similar, that there is a continuation in the symptoms. It's not that it changes to become another condition. However, the outward presentation does indeed change. So they will still have the need for sameness. They like routine and rigidity and structure. They'll have sensory issues, some difficulties with social communication. But what changes a little bit, there's several things, but one is that as you're getting older, you are learning some new social skills. So what may differ, for instance, one good example could be the difficulty with eye contact may be a persisting symptom, but outwardly in a younger child doesn't care, doesn't make eye contact. As they get older, they might learn that, some people have said it's rude, or some people have said, can you please look at me when you speak? So what they do is they will make eye contact, but when you actually, so outwardly it feels like, so eye contact improves, this symptom disappears. But when you actually speak to people with ASD, they will often say, it's very effortful for me, and I'm thinking constantly that should I make eye contact? And when they're making eye contact, they're saying that I'm thinking, is it too much? Shall I break it? When shall I look away? So obviously when you have that internal talk going on, but you're answering, let's say, another question, so it's like, uh-oh. And so then either they can make excessive eye contact, sometimes not enough, sometimes they make it fine. But the reason I'm giving this example is that how interesting, it's effortful. And then when they finish that conversation and when the other person walks out or they walk out, it'll always be like, oh, I can relax. It's a little bit like if I have hardly speak French and I go in to speak to a French person, and I have to constantly translate in my head. So when that conversation finishes, I'll be like, oh, I'm relieved now that this conversation's done. And obviously that can then take a toll. They're a bit tired and they want to take a break. So this is just an example of how the core symptom might be there, but outwardly changes. The other thing we notice, interestingly, is that when children are younger, they can avoid a lot of social contact. So children with ASD will often tell me in the clinic, parents will say, when the Amazon guy arrives, they never open the door because they're avoiding. At the cafe, they can easily order hot chocolate. They'll never order it. They'll do none of these things. And parents keep doing it. But when you become an adult, suddenly you find that you're on your own and you have to. You will avoid, if you go to Tesco's or supermarket, you'll go to the self-checkout where you can. But there will be situations where your Wi-Fi is broken, your plumbing's broken, you need to call and argue. And you'll say, okay, maybe I can write an email. But sometimes when you have to directly deal with people. So what happens to suddenly adults with ASD is they get thrown into this world where they then have to deal with these things. And they don't have a choice of, well, I'll opt out, which that's why there's more of this sense of burnout, anxiety, depression, because they're constantly doing things they don't want to do. And then there are parents also with who themselves have ASD. And sometimes I see parents in the clinic of children who also have, and they have their struggles in terms of the school saying this, I've been judged as a bad parent. And sometimes they have a lot of questions like, my child's reacting, and some of their children don't have autism, some do. So that's another area of difficulty, is that when you have to face all these problems, then therefore you have more anxiety and burnout. Similarly, children sometimes where there's a sensory issue, they will just opt out. let's say we have a lot of children with ASD who are sibling, baby, sister, or brothers crying and screaming, and they walk away. It's like, no, 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 keep them away from me. But when you have your own child as an adult, and it is your baby, and screaming is triggering your misophonia, but you don't have the choice to sort of walk away, so you will deal with it. But after you soothe the baby, another parent will just be watching YouTube, but that parent with ASD will be like, oh, I'm tired. So the other thing we find with this transition is that a lot of young people with ASD, there's quite a disconnect between what we say that if you did an IQ test and they're doing, let's say, okay, above average or even below average. But when you look at their functional skills day to day, they're much lower, interestingly. And it's not universal, but it's very common. So parents are just making sure that you attend school, you're doing well for your exams and things. But a lot of these things are done. So the minute these children go to university sometimes, and obviously I'm very clear that not all children with ASD will go to university. We often miss out on the old term that if you have a learning disability, language disorder with autism, some of those people will have intense struggles. So some of our examples today are the so-called higher functioning, but actually these also apply to people with a learning disability, that the transition, they have to do more, they have to make decisions. But coming back to my example of going to university, so I found that some young people with autism, they went to university. I'll give one example, a young person who's taking ADHD meds, and then they med, because they're an adult, their medicines are now, they have to manage it. The GP said, GP is like a family doctor in the UK, and said, come to my clinic because I haven't seen you for 6 months. This person's like, oh, I don't know, organizing, didn't go. They stopped their ADHD meds. And then they had to do everything, obviously living on their own, washing clothes, washing in the washing machine, forgot it. It smelled really badly, took it out, put it on the floor, another load. And then he thought, okay, I've run out of underwear and socks. I'll go and buy new ones, buying loads and loads of takeaway. And then parents sense something is not right. So parents drove to university and found that this young person who's now 19 or 20 is in the room, loads of clothes lying around on the floor, dirty washing, takeaways. And so then the mother said, okay, so I can see that you're doing well attending your lectures, but managing life. So she said, okay, I'm going to come every 2 weeks, wash for your clothes. And I'm going to order a delivery of food every week online. It doesn't mean they'll need it for life. It just means that those we forget sometimes in the management of, is your anxiety okay? Is your ADHD okay? That a lot of people will take a while when they transition into adult life. So they will need sometimes occupational therapy support, an life coach, a psychologist, because otherwise the... what I see is sometimes when they find it very difficult, there's a lot of black and white, meaning they'll push, and they think it's very difficult. So instead of saying, okay, I'll take a break or I'll reduce my time, what they'll do is they'll do an all or none approach, which is I left my university or I resigned from my job. So rather than saying, can I do flexi, can I do part-time, sometimes they will do, so they need support both from the employer, from the university, and somebody, because it's almost like push, then you get burnout and then you just opt out. And that sort of thing, these patterns can repeat. And I think it's that sort of thing that we look out for. But in terms of the other side where children, the changes, because I've given you only problems, the changes is that they will learn a lot of what the world expects. Okay, so if I do this in an email, I'm more likely to get a response. If I smile back, so there's also constant learning from trial and error of how to communicate. And sometimes, you know, people feel it's very artificial for me if I go and talk to someone to say, you look very lovely today, because they'll think, well, I'm here to ask you for something. Why should I say you look lovely today? But then they'll think, okay, because somebody gave me a compliment, maybe I should give them a compliment back. So there's a lot of what we call slow, natural modifications in people's social communication style into adulthood. We do see that, but it remains a bit effortful, not as natural. And the last point I would make is the same as Lavanya, that the need for sometimes psychiatric input is higher. Unfortunately, historically, a lot of people who weren't diagnosed ever with, say, ASD, and then struggle, and have a breakdown. So they're more likely to be given diagnosis of you've got a schizoaffective disorder, you've got a personality disorder, you drink a lot. But if you take a history that they always struggled with school, bullied, didn't want to go to school, had high anxiety, then started drinking alcohol as a way to manage anxiety, didn't want to go out, But we see the end state. We say, oh, this person has an alcohol addiction or this disorder. But if we trace back neurodevelopmentally, we often find people with neurodevelopmental disorders would have had struggles all their life, and then this breakdown. So high need for psychiatric input later on. And my feeling is that the more we detect early on, name it, educate people, then there'll be less of this reverse treatment that now you've got a major mental health disorder and the etiology is like, oh, you got it because you smoked this or you drank too much, or it's just because you found this job stressful. No, it's early on. There's a context for that. So that's something I think hopefully it will change as we go forward with more knowledge about ASD.
Yeah, so you're absolutely correct on that. And let's say what I see in my clinical practice, and I see what you also agree on that, that is this transitional stage that it's quite important. We should pay attention onto the child symptoms, that's for sure, but we should also think about the child's future, about the parental comfort. Also, parents often have a mental breakdown because when the child is hyperactive or they use hyperprotective strategies, behavioral strategies, so they overreact when anybody comes close to that child. They hold that kid 24 hours a day, like no sleeping. They look after the child. So sometimes it exhausts the parents themselves, but it is also causing this exhaustion in the child. That is 24 hours with this adult, and there's no social contact because they overprotect. They do not keep any social, you know, events active for that kid. And when this person, they get into an adolescence, they don't know how to behave. They do not know how it should be done. The other topic was quite important. Once I've been to the conference that was in India, in fact, in the Indian Academy of Pediatrics, and I heard everything turned upside down, you know, from the childhood to adulthood, but from adulthood to childhood. So this would happen. There was one famous professor, and he was saying about the autism, but not in the kids themselves, but it was called like autistic doctors. What does it mean? So often parents state since the early stages, they state, my kid doesn't speak, my kid doesn't react to addressed speech, my kid doesn't show what he wants, and we do not pay attention to that. We just say, oh, like, let's wait for another year or two, it will pass by. Oh, he doesn't want to speak. Just wait, no one speaks this kind of age, so let's wait a few years. And after, if symptoms persist, they say just, oh, like it didn't work out. But that is a baby that these parents have, and they will have it throughout the lifetime. So we cannot behave like that. So sometimes we have to be all reactive. Yeah, the other thing is it's just about the hearing, the hearing problem. Same about visual problem. Sometimes you do not see this tiptoe walking, we do not pay attention to that. And after we have contractures developed, or there's a necessity to do the surgery itself. Now I had one kid also in London. They made this, they had to make a surgery because no one paid attention onto the tiptoe walking in ASD child. And the contracture developed, and subsequently there was a need to do the surgery itself because nothing helped. The contracture has been fixed. Also, the problem with fine hand functioning with so-called writing. Yeah, so the doctoral writing. So sometimes we see the patient, but we do not fill in all the data. We do not state exactly what we saw. And after, when we see this patient after like 1 year or 2 years, we just forget. what happened 2 years ago, because we've seen 1,000 patients in between. So it's so important to keep our senses active, both hearing, both vision, both hand function, and it works not only for the kids. When they are transformed into an adulthood stage, they have, of course, they have problems with comorbidity, they have sensory problems, they have problems of social interaction, but still there are some skills that they may do even better than us. There was a study on, they put 50 simple person, like of maybe 25 average age, and 25 patients with ASD that were adults. And in the airport, they asked to look at the screen, at the X-ray screen, and to reveal amount of sharp subjects. And those having ASD, they revealed more than those who, like they really try to. But often we are distracted by 1,000 things, and they are concentrated pretty well on the certain aspects. So sometimes they may be great architects, they may be great cooks, they may be great in designing things. So in their areas, they are very helpful, and really throughout their lifetime, I have a lot of personal cases, and I'm sure a lot of you also know patients that now became adults with ASD, finding a good job, having families. Of course, they may have some sensitivity problems, but that is secondary. Yeah. So if you look into the mental state of each of us, we will find some depression signs, mental breakdown signs, tiredness, etc. So it is usual for each of us. But taking care of these patients socially, so paying attention onto them, paying attention onto as the doctors when they state they are tired or they are exhausted. So we should support them. Sometimes they need a sick leave. Sometimes they need support from the family members or from us. They just want to speak with us. So we have to be helpful at all. Yeah. So can you just state and mention, how do you think, what the future awaits the patients with ASD, and how may we help them? Yeah, and Dr. Damodaran, can you say just a few words?
Absolutely. I think the interest and understanding around neurodevelopmental conditions overall has been improving quite significantly. Just as everybody's pointed out, that people are fine to talk about their neurodiversity in media, social media, or other news channels, you know, whether they are to do, you know, with, you know, their own celebrity status, or whether it is children, young people, and adults that we come across within our own lives. I think people are more open to talk about it. And when people are more open to talk about it, the recognition and is there, then I suppose even healthcare system, you know, government, funding, commissioning, all of that then improves. So if you are able to put a point across, if, you know, children, young people, families with lived experience make a point about their own personal experiences, just like how, as clinicians, we've all shared our own experiences, I think that would help in, future research, commissioning within research, commissioning within clinical settings, even transitioning care from adolescent to being young adults to becoming, later part of adulthood. So these aspects would be something that I think the development is progressing, and of course, you know, use of AI, use of digital technologies in, you know, modifying our interventions, modifying the way we live, all of us, I mean, we are starting to use, you know, AI in a lot of areas that we do work in. So, you know, utilizing those digital advances in research, in interventions, in transition, all of that, I think would be really good in improving outcomes for individuals with neurodiversity, including autism.
Dr. Malik, say a few words about your opinion on this transition from childhood to adulthood. How may we be helpful, and how does it work out for you?
Yeah, so I think it's carrying on from Lavanya's point that the important thing is recognition and education. Once it's recognized much more, then transition to adulthood just becomes one other part of the whole process of autism and neurodevelopmental conditions. And I think that the main thing is that there's been a shift, not only medical, but a societal shift. So we've moved from, say, disease to it's a disorder, from disorder to it's, these are conditions, to now even a lot of people call them neurodevelopmental differences, yes? And in some cases, yes, it reaches a lot of difficult. So that's, I think, the main thing, that more education around it and better awareness in clinicians as well as individuals in society will help us support people both in adulthood and childhood. But I mean, one point I will add is that those with severe learning disability and autism, they will always be that vulnerable group because their parents advocate even when they become adults. And parents often cry saying that what will happen to my child when I'm not in this world, because they have to fight for medical issues, his shoulder has this, his skin has that. So I think that is an area that healthcare systems need to think of, people who have autism with learning disability and meeting their needs.
Thank you, Dr. Malik. And thanks to both of you, to Dr. Damodaran, to Dr. Malik, thanks for a very nice presentation of the disease and for explaining to those who listen to us this difference of ASD patients in comparison to the other groups of patients, and how may we help in this transition from the early childhood to adulthood, what are the challenges, what are the problems, comorbidities, and each of us, we should be helpful as much as possible to this group of patients, as I think it will be more and more of them in future, so they will be all around us, and we should just support them, and we should also educate our kids to communicate with them in the correct way. We do not have to be afraid of it, so that's life, and still within the last 20 years, yeah, so we see a huge increase in the amount of these patients, and it's growing up and up, this scale. So just to be helpful, just to work with these patients both socially, work in a medical way, be helpful in a medical way, and to do all what depends on us to spread information on this disease, what we are doing, in fact, now.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.